Excellent. Thank you so much for being here, everybody. Welcome to Leadership for Life 2013. My name is Joan Butterworth. I work in the Leadership Training Program in Student Services, and it's always great. This is our sixth Leadership for Life. Thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedules to come. We have a great day for you today. We have a lot of we have great speakers and workshops, and so many volunteers that are helping out with making today flow. So thank you to. I wanted to also just say thank you to all our volunteers. You want to give them? Were they helpful or what? Can we give them a hand already? Woo! Thank you. And we also have lots of people in green shirts. You might have noticed. I don't know. Maybe. No. We have lots of facilitators who are also volunteering their time for today. And they're going to be you're going to get to meet them a lot during the day, and especially at the last workshop today, the Next Steps workshop, which is going to be a really great way to synthesize and wrap up the day. So I wish you a very, very good day today. Thank you also to our sponsors, as you saw. And if you wouldn't mind, just to a note to remember to definitely try to enjoy your day. That's what the big thing. And if you can help us with keeping things cleaned up, we have recycling, and hopefully we have a compost bin somewhere too. But if you could help us with cleanup, that would be fantastic as well. So, let me just go back over here. And now, I think we're pretty much there. And I just wanted to introduce and welcome our keynote speaker. So as you know, as many of you know, we have Drew Dudley here today. It's a pleasure to introduce him for Leadership for Life to kick off with our keynote address. Drew was a former coordinator of one of the largest university development programs in Canada, but he nevertheless embraces the idea that leadership cannot really be taught, it can only be learned. As a professional speaker, writer, educator, and entrepreneur, Drew has helped raise over $5 million as the founder or chair of several organizations dedicated to supporting scholarship funds, social entrepreneurship, and charitable initiatives, including a record-breaking term as the national chair of Canada's largest fundraiser for post-secondary students, Shinerama, Students Fighting Cystic Fibrosis. Drew coordinated one of the largest university development programs in the country before taking on his current role as the founder and chief catalyst of Nuanced Leadership Incorporated, where he works with dozens of corporations, schools, charities, and other organizations around the world to empower people to increase their leadership capacities. He's also shamelessly addicted to the West Wing and has what his friends refer to as an embarrassingly large collection of stuffed penguins. So if you'll all join me in welcoming Drew Dudley. Have a great workshop.
I really, really appreciate that. Thank you. Thank you, guys. I will say that when you're 35 years old, anything more than two stuffed penguins is considered embarrassingly large by your friends. I'm thrilled to be here. I'm scared. I think some of you may have seen me speak back in orientation, and you recognize that Montreal and I don't get along. I came here in grade 8 and was left behind on a school trip. Yeah. So I didn't come for years. I did not come back for years. And then the next time I came back, I was in a terrible car accident on the highway. And then the next time I came, someone broke into my car and stole all my stuff. And I came back, and someone broke into my hotel room and stole all my stuff. And then I went all the way across Canada on a train trip, which you should do one time in your life, ride the train all the way across Canada. And in Montreal, I had to stay overnight before I changed over and went to Halifax. And I got off the train, and it had been such a good trip. And I was so upbeat. I was like, we are going to make up, Montreal, you and I. And I almost got off the train like this. Montreal, we should be friends. Some dude walks up and punches me in the stomach. And he thought I was someone else. He's like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. You think? And then he just books. I'm like, not like a, can I buy you a beer? No, he was just like, boom. Oh, sorry, wrong dude. You know how that happens. No, I've never accidentally punched someone in my entire life. But the last two times I've come here has been amazing. So if this is the third time in a row, I think it is Montreal saying to me, we should be friends. I'm sorry about all that terrible stuff I did to you. You look really pretty. Except then I got a call a couple days ago, be like, yeah, McGill flooded. I think Montreal was like, is he here yet? I don't know. Flood the place. Just flood it. So if at any point water starts pouring down here, that is it. I'm never coming back, ever. But I'm really lucky I get to travel around the world, and I get to explore with people what leadership means to them and what it means to their organizations and what it means to their communities. And I always ask the same question to start off, and I'm going to ask it to you guys here at this leadership conference. How many of you, by show of hands, are 100% completely and totally comfortable with calling yourself a leader? Overwhelming. Excellent. Don't worry about it, because I've asked that question to every audience I've spoken to for the last 3 years. Everywhere I ask it, that happens. I've asked it over 300 times, 22 times more than 30% of the audience has raised their hands. Only 22 times. Of those 22 times, 15 of them were children under the age of 10. There is something about the term that makes us uncomfortable. There's something about the term leadership that people act like we need permission to use it. Like one day you hope you get a job or a business card that when people look at it, they go, nice, leader. But to just use the title on our own without somebody giving us permission to use it, what I've discovered in my research is that most people say they're worried that makes them look cocky and arrogant. So people don't put their hands up. And now all the people who did were like, oh, did I just look cocky and arrogant? Instead, I think what's happened is we made leadership into something bigger than us. We make leadership into something beyond us. And we make leadership about changing the world. And what we say is that if what I do doesn't change the world, if it's not big enough, what actually happens is that I have no right to use the title. And what I worry about is that we spend so much time in our society celebrating amazing things that hardly anyone can do. What we've done is we've convinced ourselves that those are the only things we're celebrating. And we say, look at these giants. Look at Steve Jobs innovate. Look at Bill Gates and Warren Buffett invest. Look at Madonna perform. Look at Tiger Woods used to play golf. And we say those are the giants. And if we don't play at that same level, to call ourselves leaders as well actually makes us look foolish. What I believe is that when we choose to look at leadership that way, what happens is we actually devalue the leadership that we actually demonstrate every day. And we let moments of leadership pass us by, and we don't let ourselves take credit for them, and we don't let ourselves feel good about them. The things that human beings decide on their own that they want to do most often are the things that make us feel good. So when we let moments of leadership pass by and we don't let ourselves take credit for them, and we let our friends and the people we love and the people we work with let leadership pass by and we don't make sure that they get to take credit for it, what we're doing is we're pulling leadership out of our lives, we're pulling it out of our world, and I think that we need it. So for 15 years, I've gotten to work with these amazing people who helped me redefine what leadership means to me. And I want to share with you the story of that redefinition in the hope that it resonates with those of you who didn't raise your hand and the ones who it did as well. And I want to start with a story that I tell everywhere I go. And when I left I went to a little tiny university on the east coast of Canada called Mount Allison University. None of you have heard of it. It's in a place called Sackville, New Brunswick, which is exciting as it sounds. And I was there for 7 years. And on the last day that I was there, they threw me a goodbye party, and this young woman walked up to me, and she said, Drew, I remember the first time that I ever met you. And I said, oh, great. No idea who she was. And don't you love it when people use your name and you have no idea who they are? So you cover it up. Thanks, kiddo. She shakes her head and goes, look. And she told me a story from 4 years earlier. And she said, 4 years ago was the night before I started university. And I was in a hotel room with my mom and my dad. And for whatever reason, the night before, I just got overwhelmed with this feeling like I couldn't do this. I wasn't ready for it. And she goes, so I started to cry. It was really, really intense. And my parents hadn't seen me cry in 8 years. But I was in a hotel room, and there was nowhere to hide. And they were amazing. They said, look, we know you were scared. Trust us. We are way more scared than you are. But you've worked so hard for this. Like, you owe it to yourself. You've always wanted to do this. Let's go tomorrow to the first day. And if at any point in the day you feel like you can't do this, just tell us. We'll take you home. We love you no matter what. And she said they were right. My whole life I had been told, you got to go to university. It's what successful people do. And so I'd killed myself for that. So I said, let's go. And I got in line on the first day, and it was so loud. And everybody was screaming and cheering, and they had stupid face paint on, and they were doing this weird pelvic thrust thing that I really wasn't totally comfortable with. And she goes, I've never been an extrovert. And I looked around, and I said, here I am again at a place where only extroverts are valued. And she said, I can't do this again. And she goes, I quit. Standing in line, I quit. And as soon as I did, I was overcome with this incredible feeling of peace. Like, I am so okay with that decision. And I turned to my mom and my dad to tell them to take me home like they said they would. And before I could say anything, you came out of the nearest building wearing the stupidest hat I have ever seen a human being wear in my life. I know. It's like this Franken fedora here, which is two of them stitched together. And she says, you had this giant sign that said Shinorama, Students Fighting Cystic Fibrosis, which is a charity I've been involved with for years. And you had a giant bucket full of lollipops. And you're walking along and you're handing lollipops out to the people in line, to their parents and to students, trying to get them to do Shinorama. And all of a sudden you got to me and you stopped and you stared at me. She won't look. It was creepy. This girl knows exactly what I'm talking about. But then you looked at the guy next to me, and you pull a lollipop out of your bucket, and you hold it out to this guy, and you go, dude, you have got to give a lollipop to the beautiful, beautiful girl you are standing next to in line. Do not miss this chance. Come on, man. She goes, I've never seen this dude before in my life, but I have never seen a human being get more embarrassed faster in my life. He turns beet red, and he won't even look at me. He just does this. And I felt so bad for this guy that I take the lollipop from him. And as soon as I do, you get this really, really mean look on your face. And you turn to my parents to be played in a bold casting decision by you two. And you go, look at your little girl. Look at your daughter. It is her first day away from home. Her first day without mom and dad to take care of her. And you know what she's doing already? She is taking candy from a complete and total stranger. She goes, everybody loses it in 20 feet in every direction. Everybody starts to howl. She goes, I don't know why, but in that moment when everybody was over laughing, like I don't know if you've ever been super stressed and someone says something mildly amusing and you lose it. She's like, everyone was doing that. But in that moment, I changed my mind and I didn't leave. And you know, I haven't talked to you once in the 4 years since that day, but I heard that you were leaving. And before that happened, I had to come up to you and tell you, you have been an incredibly important person in my life and I'm really going to miss you. So good luck, all right? And she walks off. And I have no concept of how to process that conversation. So I'm standing there stunned, and she gets about 6 feet away, and she comes back, and she goes, there's one more thing that you should probably know. I've been dating that guy for 4 years since that day. Oh, wait. A year and a half after I moved away, they invited me to their wedding. She married the dude. Good luck. But here's the kicker. I don't remember that. I have no recollection of that moment. And I've searched my memory banks because I was awesome in that moment, and I would like to remember being that awesome once in my life. But it was such an eye-opener for me to realize that maybe the biggest moment of leadership in my life, like maybe a moment that had a girl walk up to a complete stranger 4 years later, maybe the most powerful impact I'd ever had on another human being was a moment that I didn't even remember. And what it really opened my eyes to is the fact that we spend a lot of time, a lot of money, and a lot of stress on things that we think will shape how others think of us in a positive way. What I've discovered is the biggest impact that we have on how other people think about us are often the things we're not paying attention to. And what I've discovered is that in my research, when people evaluate themselves as people and as leaders, we tend to focus a tremendous amount on the extraordinary days in our lives. And there are extraordinary days in our lives, days where things happen that don't usually happen. And they can be good. I mean, you can pass something you thought you were going to fail. You can get the job. You can get a raise. You can hook up with the person you want to. All right, these are good extraordinary days. And then there are negative extraordinary days where you fail at something, where you don't get something you thought you deserved, where you hurt somebody that you care about. And we can learn a lot about ourselves from those extraordinary days. And I don't deny that. But what I think we have to remember is that those extraordinary days in our lives are always outnumbered by the everydays in our lives. And I think that the nature and the frequency of extraordinary days in our lives are determined by how we behave in the everydays. But when we decide whether or not we deserve the title of leader, when we evaluate whether or not we're impressive, we take this very small subsample, this tiny little percentage of the days of our lives, and we use them to decide, are we extraordinary? And part of it's how we've been taught. Like, you guys will go to school for 12 weeks. And in some of your classes, your marks will be determined by 2 midterms and a final. All right, all that work, 3 big days. Guess what? The problem is we spend the rest of our lives evaluating ourselves in the same way. It's not the sum total of the work we do. It's how we perform on those very rare few days. And after 20 years of being evaluated that way, is it really a surprise that we keep doing it? But what I've discovered is that the most successful leaders I know, the most extraordinary organizations, are the ones that put a tremendous amount of focus on everyday leadership, how you behave in those everyday moments. There's an old adage that says, you're only as good as you are when nobody is watching. I change it. You're only as good as you are when no one's watching, because somebody's always watching. And that's what that girl showed me. What I want to talk about today is how to change the world by hardly changing. I want to talk about if the most successful leaders I know tend to focus on everyday leadership, they make sure that it's acknowledged, that it's fostered, and that it's rewarded. All of the people who do that effectively tend to do a certain number of things. I want to share with you what those things are. I also call it Untitled for Everyday Leadership, because I'm addicted to the work of a guy named Seth Godin. And I was at an interview with him once, and he said, never, ever trust anybody who gives you a list of tips. And so I had to change the damn title of my presentation. So now it is definitely not tips for everyday leadership. But these are the things that I find the most powerful leaders do on a consistent basis. The first thing is they screw the list. This is a woman by the name of Allison Elwood on the left. Allison, I brought her in to speak when I worked at the University of Toronto. I brought her in to speak to my first and second year students in the leadership development program, because she biked from Victoria, British Columbia to Cape Spear, Newfoundland. She took 5 months and rode her bike all the way across the country to collect the stories of women who had battled and beaten breast cancer. Because she said that that story is the story of our time. And her mother had become a part of that story. And she said, when my mother heard the stories of other women who had beaten this disease, it gave her hope, and I think that those stories saved her life. So what I want to do is make sure that every woman in this country who's diagnosed with breast cancer, and it's 1 in 5 Canadian women, has the chance to share those stories like my mom did and feel that same sort of hope. So she said, I'm going to bike across Canada, and she did it. She took 5 months out of her life and had these extraordinary adventures. And I said, come in and tell my students this. So she came in and she told this story. And as she's telling it, I'm watching her become, in the eyes of my students, exactly what she is, which is an amazing woman to look up to admire, to emulate, until the very end of the presentation. Because at the very end of the presentation, one of my students puts up their hand and asks the only question that sometimes I think U of T students care about. What university did you go to? And Allison, to her enduring credit, laughs and goes, a better question would be, what university didn't I go to? I dropped out 4 times. She goes, look, I was told university was about freedom, about exploring yourself and discovering new things. On the first day I went to school, I had 4 different professors give me a double-sided sheet of paper. And on it was exactly what I had to do, how many words I had to do it, how big my margins could be, how big my font was allowed to be, when they expected it, and what happened to me if I didn't give it to them on time. And she said, I did not see any freedom on any of those sheets of paper. So I left. And then I went back to college, had the same thing happen. I kept going back to schools because that's what I was told to do. Everyone's like, okay, well, you're going to go back, right? Because otherwise you're detonating your life. So she goes, 4 times. Finally, I found a place that actually made me feel like I could explore who I was. She got 2 degrees. She goes, but yeah, a better question would be, where didn't I go to school? I dropped out 4 times. And the response to that answer is one I will never forget. Because my students looked at her like she had 2 heads. Like, they looked at her as if she had done something wrong. After her telling this story, my students looked at her like they were disappointed in her. And I will never forget that. And I realized at that moment how extraordinarily powerful the list is. And it is a list that exists in everybody's mind of the things that you think you have to do for you to be a success. It is a list of the things that you think you have to accomplish in your life for you to be a person of worth. It is a list of things you think you have to check off so you have the right to raise your hand, or so that you are not a disappointment to anybody. And I think that that list is never explicitly taught, but it is learned. And it can be extraordinarily restricting. And I think the list looks like this. Go to kindergarten and play nice. Go to elementary school and do what the teacher tells you. Go to high school so that you can go to a good university, which usually means do what the teacher tells you. Go to a good university so you can get a big, fat starting salary. Get a big, fat starting salary. Get promoted. Get yourself into a serious long-term relationship, preferably a heterosexual one. Get promoted. Get married. Get promoted. Buy a house. Get promoted. Have kids. Get promoted a couple more times. Make sure that your kids do exactly the same thing. And I watch extraordinary people act like their lives are some sort of giant scavenger hunt, and we are all handed out a card with that list on it at the beginning, and we are told, quick, race to check off as many of these as you possibly can, because everyone else is racing with you. So go. And I liked that game, because I was really good at it. And I was told very young, Drew, you have the ability to kick the list's ass, so we expect that from you. And is there any feeling worse than feeling like somehow you are letting down the people who believe in you? So I killed myself to go through this list. And I was 25 years old, mid-20s, and I was beating myself up one day because I had not completed something on the list in time. I was supposed to have it done by 24. I was now 25. I suck. And for the first time in my life, I looked at this list of things I was using to determine my worth, and I realized I didn't write it. I was living my life according to somebody else's agenda. I do not know what the list of things you are chasing in your life so that you can feel like you are someone of worth. I do not know what the things you believe you have to check off are before you feel like you're not a disappointment to yourself and the people who love you. All I can tell you is this: whatever that list of things you are chasing is, please make sure that you wrote it. Please make sure that it's your list. It's not your parents or your brothers and sisters or your boyfriends or your girlfriends or your professors or what you think society expects from you. Because if you spend your life chasing a list of somebody else's goals, you are always going to feel unfulfilled. And what I love about this woman, Allison, is she had the courage to keep making changes in her life until it was life that she wanted and the life that she deserved. And guess what? You have the right to do that too. As a matter of fact, I think you have an obligation to do it. I think leaders fundamentally do that. The problem is we scare the hell out of you about doing that. Because what we do is we tell thousands of young people every year this one truth. If you just work hard enough, it will all pay off in the end. Okay? If you just work hard enough, it will all pay off in the end. My problem is this. We never tell you how hard is hard enough, do we? And we don't do a very good job helping you figure out what you actually want the payoff in your life to be. And we never tell you when the end will come. So we have these amazing people chasing this undefined goal on this undefined timeline, and it drives people nuts. If you just work hard enough, it will all pay off in the end. Here's the problem. That's an extremely dangerous thing to say. Because I've watched it make thousands of young people like you guys think that what your professors think of you and what your potential future employers think of you is somehow more important than what you think of yourself. And I've watched it make thousands of young people believe that the entire purpose of the educational experience is to figure out what the market wants, learn it, and then turn around and offer it directly back to the market, regardless of whether it has anything to do with what makes you interested, what makes you passionate, and it has anything to do with what you're gifted at. And the worst thing is it tells all of the dancers and the musicians and the singers and the actors and actresses and the entrepreneurs and the change agents in this room and everyone in this room whose brilliance cannot be measured on essays and on tests, it tells all of you that your gifts aren't gifts at all. They're only gifts if one day they could be monetized. Otherwise, they should just be hobbies. And what bothers me is that could not be more true. And I wonder how old people are in our education system before they start to look up and say, wow, I'm not very good at the list. How old people are before they start looking at teachers and going, that teacher thinks that I can't do the things on the list. Are they 7? Are they 8? How different would our society be? How many more people would raise their hands if people stopped doing that to 8-year-olds? There are 4 things that I believe are necessary for more people to raise their hands. 4 truths that I think that will lead to more leaders in this world. And if they resonate with you, share them with other people. And here's those 4 truths. 1, you are way more brilliant than you give yourself credit for. And you're welcome. And you are way more brilliant than the tests that we have to give you allow you to ever show completely. 2, school is the last place that you will spend time in your life where the ability to do well on a test is valued more than the ability to actually do something or help someone or change something. And you will hopefully spend so much more time in your life doing things, helping people, and changing things than you will writing tests, that you owe it to yourself to be as good or better at those things than you are at writing tests when you leave this place. 3, success in leadership cannot be measured by money and by job titles. And straight A's will not get you a direct path to either one of those 2 things. Success in leadership comes from striving to act every day in a way that makes it more likely you'll have a positive impact on your own life and on the lives of other people. And the 4th truth, I think, is this. You should work incredibly hard to make your grades extraordinary. All right, your transcript will open doors for you. Your transcript will kick down doors for you. Your transcript is an incredibly important part of your life. It is not a measure of your worth as a human being. And I am tired of watching extraordinary young people believe that because they are a C student, they are somehow a C person. And if we want to be leaders, I think we got to do two things. One, never allow ourselves to confuse the letters that come on pieces of paper with who we are as human beings. And two, never allow anyone we care about to allow themselves to be convinced of the same thing. Your grades are an incredibly important part of your life. I do not deny that. But here is what I believe. You should work incredibly hard to make your grades extraordinary. And this is what should be in 15-foot letters on the wall of every educational institution, from kindergarten all the way to the end of university. You should work incredibly hard to make your grades extraordinary, and then you should work twice as hard to make sure that they are the least impressive thing about you. Because I honestly believe if you do that, success and leadership is going to follow you all the days of your life. We think that change means failure. We think if we change something in our life, we have to admit to ourselves and everybody watching that we failed. All right, if we change what we study, where we go to school, who we're dating, we feel like what we're saying is, I screwed up the first time. And we have to admit that to everybody watching. Life is an exploration. Leadership is an exploration. There is no exploration without change. Be willing to keep making changes in your life until it's the life that you want and the life that you deserve. That's the first thing that the most extraordinary leaders I know do. The second one is they change their goals to this one here. I gave a speech at a business conference. Anyone here a business student? One of those business conferences that talks completely about thinking outside the box and constantly innovating and being different, and everybody's wearing a suit at 9 o'clock on a Saturday. We should all be different and innovative. You're all wearing the same suit, seriously. And a guy came up to me and he said, Drew, I've seen you speak 3 times this year, and I really like your stories. I was like, oh, thanks, man. And he throws me a complete curveball. He goes, do you want to know what's wrong with you? I was like, who wants to pass up the chance to have a complete stranger tell you what's wrong with you, right? So I said, fire away. And he says, you never tell anybody how to win. And I said, win what? And he rolls his eyes at me and he says, dude, this is a game. It's a game. We've always known it's a game. We've known it's a game since the first time they gave us a grade. Why on earth would they be grading us if it wasn't to rank us and make sure the people at the top get stuff that people at the bottom don't get? He said, it's a game, Drew. There's only so much money, and there's only so many jobs. And if I don't get them, somebody else will. That's the reality. And you're not doing anybody any favors by telling them there's a different reality, by telling them it's the little things they do that count. All right? All you're doing is you're setting people up to get destroyed in the game. You want to be helpful? Stop doing that. Start telling people how to win. And then he turned and walked off. Because debate sucks. But making your point and stomping off, you rock. And so I'm standing there, but I was really upset by that because he's 100% right. In all the speaking I've done, I've never told anybody how to win. I've never told anybody how to win. And maybe if I'm going to take an hour of your life on a Saturday, I owe it to you to give you my best advice on how to win that game. So here it is. Please don't play that game. There are no winners in that game. There are just people who have been beaten. Because once we adopt this idea that it's a game, school is a game, work is a game, life is a game, we embrace this idea that there are winners and there are losers. And as soon as we start thinking that, we start to live in a world of scarcity, where there's only so much, we're all fighting for it. And anything you get is something I don't get. Any success that you achieve is success I can't get. Eventually, it's the Hunger Games. Okay? There could only be one left. The problem is that perception of a world of scarcity, one that's reinforced by schools that say, you're so lucky you got to come here because all the people we said no to, you've already won. All right? We reinforce this idea it's a world of scarcity. And I think the idea that we live in a world of scarcity is what leads to so many of the things we hate about this world. It's what leads to prejudice. It's what leads to hatred. It's what leads to anger. It's what leads to the bullying that begins on playgrounds and goes all the way up to corporate offices. This idea that we live in a world of scarcity makes people think that we can never, ever truly work together without giving up something of ourselves that we eventually don't get. So much of the work that I do is to try to convince people to decide to live in a different type of economy. Because I think right now we live in that economy of scarcity. And I believe that we can choose to live in an economy of abundance. Because maybe there is only so much money. And maybe there are only so many jobs. But I honestly believe there is no limit to the amount of self-worth that is available. There is no limit to the amount of satisfaction that is available. And there is no limit to the amount of happiness that is available to us if we can find a way to separate self-worth, satisfaction, and happiness from our transcripts, our paychecks, and our job titles. That's incredibly difficult to do because we have never been taught that. I spent a decade and a half in higher education. And I've learned that there are things that are learned that are never explicitly taught. And one of the underpinning concepts of our educational society is that the secret to happiness is freedom. The secret to freedom is money. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to teach you what you need to know to make money, and then you can have freedom and happiness, and you will do good things with it. We know it. And the problem is, so we send out people through our systems that chase jobs and money as the primary goals in their life. And guess what? After 35 years in this world, I will tell you something. Jobs and money make lousy life goals. You know why? Because you're not in charge of any of them. Like, how hard you work and how well you work will always play a role in how much money you make. But ultimately, as long as you work for somebody else, and most of us will spend most of our lives working for somebody else, as long as you work for somebody else, how much money you make is somebody else's decision. If you get promoted or a bigger job title, it's because somebody else has the right to decide that's what you get. You get an award or recognized in any way, it's because somebody else is in a position where they get to decide that's what you get. And I think when we tie our life goals to someone else's whims, it's tremendously disempowering. I think it's why so few people raise their hands, because deep down inside we know that the things we are chasing in our life that we have to get so that we feel fulfilled have to be handed to us from somebody else. And guess what? It's hard to feel like a leader when that is your reality. And for 20-some years for most of you, that's been your reality. The things that make you feel good, the things that get you accolades are handed to you from somebody else. And I honestly believe that we can change that. What's the other option, right? Well, my life in an economy of abundance and all of the personal success and the business success and the financial success and more importantly the happiness that have come with it, it came when I said I will only have one goal in my life. I will no longer have any goals in my life that someone else has to hand me. I will only have one goal in my life and ultimately I'm always in charge of it. And that goal is that. I will endeavor to add tremendous value in every single interpersonal interaction of which I'm a part. Add value. I think those two words are the key to the economy of abundance. What do they mean? Well, I think that adding value means trying to give people something they didn't even know they needed and something they didn't even know they wanted every single time that they interact with you. I think that adding value means no longer asking, what do I need to do to make more money? What do I need to do to get a better job? What do I need to do to shine brighter than everyone around me? I think it means asking, who do I need to be the type of person who is great at a job? Who do I need to be the type of person who makes everyone around me look better? Because I will tell you a reality of the business world and the work world. If you can outperform everybody, you will make six figures. If you can become the type of person who helps everyone who works with you outperform everyone who doesn't work with you, you will run companies. And you will have tremendously positive impact in the world. Adding value. Fundamentally, it means no longer treating jobs and money as goals in and of themselves, but recognizing that they are the natural byproducts that come to people who add tremendous value. Don't chase money, jobs, respect, prestige. Figure out how you can add tremendous value. Put your time and effort into making yourself even better at that, and all of those other things will come as the natural byproduct. Living in an economy of abundance does not mean you give up on dreams of business success or personal financial wealth. It doesn't. Living in an economy of abundance doesn't mean that you stop thinking about profit. Trust me, I think about profit. But it means you recognize that profit is only one type of value. And whoever adds the most value inevitably reaps the biggest profits. Financially, socially, emotionally, spiritually, and psychologically as well. How do we do it? How do we make sure that we add tremendous value on a daily basis? I think we need to define the things that we want to define us. I gave a first year lecture on leadership theory at U of T. And theory is the word you add to interesting things to make them boring. Like, pizza is awesome. Pizza theory sucks. And at the end of it, she came up and she said what every educator on the planet loves to hear, which is, I don't get it. And I said, oh, what don't you get? And she says, I don't understand leadership anymore. And I said, we have all semester. Don't worry about it. She goes, no, I understood it before I came in here. Now I don't understand it anymore. And now that's what I hope happens. At the time, I thought I had failed. And she said, look, I'm an international student, and English is my third language. And she speaks it incredibly well. And she says, where I'm from, leaders are supposed to be the smartest people. And the smartest people get the best grades in school, so when you get the best grades in school, you get to call yourself a leader. Otherwise, you don't. After listening to you, I think leadership means something different in Canadian. Can you tell me what leadership means in simple English? I don't know if you've ever, can you tell me what leadership means in simple English? Have you guys ever been so certain you know the answer to a question until somebody asks you the question and then you choke on it? This is one of my favorites. Hi. Caroline? Why do you matter? sucks, doesn't it? Don't worry about it. And I'm not, sorry, you got stuck on that one. Many of you have dropped a significant amount of money already on your education. You've been doing it for 20-some years. And the fact that I can look, and I do that all the time to university students, I ask them that question, and they can't give me an answer. And we call this education? Like, so many of you were like, why do I matter? Of course I know the answer to that. Why would I function if I didn't know that? Till somebody asked you. That girl did that to me when she said, what does leadership mean in simple English? And I opened my mouth to give my genius answer. And the left side of my brain said to my right, yeah, I got nothing. And that bugged me, because leadership was a value I wanted to embody every day in my life, and I choked on the question. And I went home that night and I did something I've never done. And I encourage you guys to do it in your head right now. I listed the list of values I want to embody every day in my life. So pick three in your head right now, the values you want to embody every day in your life. Because I realized something. How I felt about myself was based on how well I lived up to my values. And I had never defined them. No wonder I always felt crappy about myself, right? So I went home and I listed the values I wanted to embody every day. I was 28 years old. It was the first time I ever did it. Here's part of the list. And making the list was no problem whatsoever. I ripped them off in a hurry. Now, then I went through each one of them and said, I imagine that girl walked up to me and said, I'm sorry, English is my third language. What does respect mean? And I realized that given 5 or 10 minutes, I could come up with tremendously good definitions for all of my values. But I had never done it before. And here's the problem. If we don't define the things that we want to define us, we will always feel unfulfilled. Because if you say you want to embody respect every day of your life, and that's important to you, if you have never defined what respect is, you could be embodying it every day of your life, and you've never given yourself permission to celebrate it. Guys, setting goals is basically planning celebrations. And so you know what we should do? We should at least give ourselves, when it comes to the goal of living our values, we should at least give ourselves a target. So you know what? Identify your values. Make the list of them, guys. Then define what each one of your values means. Imagine someone walked up to you and said, what does this mean? I don't understand. Like, English is my first language. And then there's the third step. You got to create deliberate steps so that you can live each value every day. When you come up with the list and when you define them, what you've done is you've given yourself a set of criteria you can use to make decisions that are consistent with your values. Leadership isn't just making decisions consistent with your values when the opportunity presents itself. It's being conscious about creating opportunities to live your values. So that's exactly what I think needs to happen. Because leadership, I think, is making one big decision to make a series of really good, consistent, small decisions. And I think that allows us to do the fourth step, which is to plan to matter. I do it with questions. What I did is I said, walk around being like, I want to embody respect today is kind of nebulous. So I said, I'm going to create questions that if I ask them and I answer them every day, I will know that I have lived my values. So I will create a question related to a value, and then all I'll do is I'll seek opportunities to answer that question every day. So here are the 6 questions that I carry around with me every day and look for chances to answer. And I wanted to embody impact every day, making sure people left me feeling as if they were better off for having interacted with me. So I asked my day every day, what have I done today to be helpful? My favorite story about this one, because I had it in my head, I had just come up with it, and I'm like, I'm looking for a chance to use it. And I got into line at a grocery store on a Saturday. Don't go to grocery stores on a Saturday. It's Cirque du Soleil in there. And the cashier was a ninja. Like, she was amazing. There was 20 people in line, and she was incredible. And it's so weird, eh? We will celebrate the world's best athlete, the world's best business person, the world's best. If the job has very few people who can do it, we will celebrate excellence all day long. Jobs that everybody can do, or that tons of people do, we never seem to celebrate excellence. We very rarely be like, that is the greatest waitress I've ever seen. She is the greatest cashier I've ever seen. It's like the more people who can do a job, the less important it is to recognize excellence in that job. And I sat there for 20 minutes and watched this woman be a superstar. And everyone was mean to her. I don't know why, like maybe everyone had a bad day, but they all kept making this noise. Anyone in the service industry, do you know this one? Anyone who does that, you should be allowed to taser them. How different would our world be if everybody in the service industry got one free taser a year? That was it. You could do it to one person. But you never know if your waitress has used her up. All right, it's November, and you're like, has she tased someone this year? I'll just be nice to her. But I got to the front, and she was so close to like snapping that I said, I got to do something nice for this woman. So I turned to the candy counter, and I said, excuse me, which of these chocolates do you think is the best? And she snaps at me, the caramels! You've not lived till you've had caramels snapped at you angrily. I put them down, and she beeped them, and she went to beep them through. And she went to put them in the bag, and I said, no, actually, I got those for you. You look like you're having a really bad day. And I thought you could have some chocolates. I wanted her to smile. That's all, because that question was in my mind. What have I done today to be helpful? And because I was looking for a chance to answer it, I said, okay, this is my chance. And I wanted her to smile. That was it. And she started to cry. Not what I was going for. Because now there's 20 people in line, right, thinking that I made this woman cry. And I said, I'm so sorry. And she goes, no, it's just that no one's even been polite to me today, and you bought me chocolates. I have no idea how to process this. And I thought, but you know what? It's because I had this question in my mind. Man, when she went home to her family, before that happened, I bet when they said, how was your day, she's going to snap at them and pull value out of their life. Now I bet you if nothing else good happens, she leaves with this guy did the nicest thing for me today. And it's because I was carrying this question with me. I just thought it would be this little thing, like when you buy Tim Hortons for the person behind you in line, and you all nod, like you've done it a million times. You did it 4 years ago, and you've been coasting on it ever since. Right? And I do the same thing. But carrying that question around with me allowed me to embody impact every day. What have I done today to make it more likely that I will learn something? Because personal growth is important to me, which I define as learning things that I'll never be tested on. Because I don't get it. Like, I've actually had people be like, that's a good point. Will that be on the midterm? No, so obviously it's an unimportant thing to remember, okay? That's why I love TED, TED.com. It has introduced an entire generation of people to the fact there are things worth knowing that you will not be tested on. All right, let's re-embrace that idea. What have I done today to make it more likely someone else will learn something? I love dropping off a book on someone's desk or sending them an article and being like, I was thinking of you, I saw this, and I thought you would find it interesting. Because one, I was thinking of you. Nice. Two, when I say I saw this and I thought you'd find it interesting, what I am saying every day to someone is, I think you have a brain and I think you know how to use it. That's a nice thing to say to people every day. Now, if it's like a Dr. Seuss book, I thought you would find this interesting. Or it's like a How to Not Be an Ass for Dummies, okay? Like, but that's just I thought you might find this interesting. But I go out looking for that every day. Oh, what have I said about someone to their face today? And this is one of those things we think we do so often that we've stopped doing it. There are things that we are so capable of doing that we just figure we'll get around to it and we push them off. Bring it back and be conscious about it. Because the guy who suggested this to me, I said, Kyle, I do that all the time. And he said, oh, okay. Who have you done it to today and what did you say? And I said, shut up, Kyle. I love Kyle because every time I'd get angry at Kyle, I'd say, why did you do that? And he would always answer, because I'm awesome. And finally, I said, Kyle, why do you give every answer as, because I'm awesome? And he goes, better question, Drew, is why don't you? And I was like, I hate it when I get schooled by like that. And English is a language of qualifiers. Like, our language is, for those of you who are first, like, native English speakers, and those of you who learned it, you know how confusing this language is. We have so many words that mean probably not, just, maybe, possibly. Like, we are taught as we grow up so many different ways of being like, yeah, that probably won't happen. Probably won't happen. And one of the most powerful ones is the word just. Just, we use it all the time. I'm just a student. I'm just starting out. I'm just trying to get this done. Here's the thing. Every time we use the word just, we are giving people permission to expect less from us. Well, I just think, really, you know what you just said? Everything that's about to come out of my mouth, you can ignore. I'm an idiot. But we do it just. We use it all the time. One of the most powerful things that we can do as leaders is to not allow people who we care about to diminish themselves in front of us. So start calling people out on their justs. Because there are people in our lives who think they are just people. I call them the just people. And that makes no sense. But here's what I mean by that. I had to go back and speak at my old high school in March, last March. And that's terrifying. All right, because when you walk through the front door of your old high school, you immediately revert back to the person you were in high school. And I was not cool in high school at all. But there was this one guy, and his name was Mr. Kiff, and he was the head custodian at our high school. And he knew everybody's name. He was the kindest man I'd ever known. And not only did he know everyone's name, he learned like 600 new names every September, but he knew exactly who was alienated and who was bullied and who felt like an outcast. And he would just stop and talk to you in the hall. And I was one of those people. And I went back, and I was in the principal's office at 35. That's still freaky. Because they didn't used to ask you if you want coffee. And he saw me, and he comes busting in. He's like, oh, my God, Drew. And he gives me this big hug. And I couldn't believe he remembered me. And I said, Mr. Kiff, like, I can't believe you remember who I am. And he goes, are you kidding me? I've been following everything that you do. I'm so proud of you. And I have no idea, but the phrase, I'm so proud of you, is an incredibly powerful thing to hear. I don't know why we don't use it more often, because every time you hear it, you feel incredible. I don't know why we don't turn around and start passing it on. But I was so moved when he said that to me that I said to him, Mr. Kiff, look, you've been an incredibly important person in my life at a time I wasn't very good with myself, and I wanted you to know that you've been a really important guy in my life. And he said, oh man, I'm just a janitor who knew you before you were big. And that phrase, just a janitor, that's why I started talking about this. Because there have been thousands of people who've gone through my high school. And they've gone on to become doctors, lawyers, CEOs, all the things that we're supposed to celebrate in life. And if you walk into one of their offices, and I've tested this, and you say the name Mr. Kiff, they smile. They smile. 15 years after the last time they've even thought of him, they hear his name and they smile. And I think that is an extraordinary life. And I think that is a life of leadership. And I think if you want to ask yourself, are you a leader? Ask yourself, am I behaving in a way that makes it more likely that 15 years from now, someone who used to work with me will hear my name in a room I am not in, and they will smile. And I think, ask yourself, if you strip away jobs and money, you're not allowed to consider those things. Jobs, money, and marks, strip them away. If you listed the people who live their lives in a way that impress you, who would it be? Whose life is worth emulating if you're not allowed to consider those other things? For me, it would be a guy like Mr. Kiff. And I think we need to ask ourselves who those people are in our lives. We need to go up and tell them, you live your life in a way that impresses me. But more importantly, we actually use these words. You are a leader to me. Because too many people don't think they're leaders. And we know that they are the type of people who impress us with the way they live their lives. Tell them that. Because you know why? Because they'll keep living their life that way. Leadership recognized is leadership created. I think one of the most powerful things we can do is every day find a way to recognize someone else's leadership and tell them to their face that it matters. What positive thing have I said about someone who isn't even in the room? Who says talking behind each other's back has to be negative? Like, you know one of the biggest ways you can raise respect for yourself? Say good things about people when they're not in the room. People start to assume you're doing it about them as well. And the last one. Well, if you know somebody in your life who slams someone else behind their back, you could be like, yes, I hate that person too. You never really trust them again because they've already proven they'll do that crap when it serves their purpose. Say good things about people when they're not in the room. It changes the way people feel about you. And the last one's incredibly hard. What have I done today to be good to myself? I do not get how we expect boyfriends and girlfriends, professors and parents, bosses, the universe, to do something for us that we will not do for ourselves, and that is to treat ourselves well. Okay, you cannot add value to other people's lives until you've added value to your own. It is not self-absorbed to do things to renew the value in your own life so that you have more that you can give away. We think that leadership or impressive is like pouring everything you have out so you're empty. Once you're empty, not only can you not add value, you start to suck it from everybody around you. Wish I hadn't said that out loud. But I'll edit that. And so I think it's important. So you know what? Pick something that makes you feel like you've been good to yourself. Watch the terrible television show. I still make times for Grey's Anatomy, and I feel dirty the whole time, but I don't care, okay? Read 50 Shades of Grey. I do it on a Kindle, so they don't see me doing it on the airplane. Like, eat the cheesecake, okay? I have so much value stored up. Ha 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 ha. Pick something to be good to yourself. Those are 6 questions. 4 to add value to other people, 2 to add value to myself. I carry those around with me, and I know if I answer them every day, I know that I've added value. 2,000 pieces of value a year. How's that not leadership? Take your values, define what they are, and then create questions that make it simple to live them every day. You know how I'm good to myself? I'm on the road 200 days a year. 200 days a year I'm away from people I love and care about deeply. And that can be lonely, because there is nothing quite as lonely as half a hotel bed, I swear to you. But I put the photographs in this presentation are all photographs I got to take because I do this job. And I love this job, but there's trade-offs in everything. But this makes me so happy. So when I speak, I get to look at photographs of moments that made me blissfully happy. And I get to do it every day at work. I get to remind myself. And you know how I came up with it? Because I started asking myself, what have I done to be good to myself today? And I never would have thought of it otherwise. I know, he's adorable, isn't he? He's not. You don't see 5 minutes later when he's like... So it's created these questions that allowed me to come up with that little thing that I do every day to be good to myself. Something incredibly important you can do to be good to yourself is stop letting people live rent-free in your head. That's the desert of Qatar. I was in the Middle East, and I decided I wanted to go dune blasting. And dune blasting, by the way, means getting in a car and driving off 100-foot sand cliffs. And it said in the brochure that my guide will help keep me alive in the desert overnight. I think there was a translation issue there. They wanted to word that more strongly. So I called up, and they said, your guide will be there at 7 a.m. And I walked out at 7 a.m. in front of my hotel, and there was this man. This is the only time all day he wasn't smiling, because he says, in photographs, the ladies like it when you look intense. And I come towards the car, and he throws his arms open. He goes, "Welcome to Mustafa's grand adventure. I am Mustafa." And I went, "Mustafa, like the Lion King." And he completely deadpans. He looks at me and goes, "That's Mufasa." And I thought, well, he's not going to help keep me alive in the desert anymore, is he? But he's like, "I'm just kidding you, Drew. I'm kidding you. Get in the car." And he's talking. He wants to know all about Canada. And he starts talking about what we're going to learn from the desert. And he's got so much energy. An hour and a half in, I finally go, "Mustafa, dude, it's 7 a.m. Where do you get your energy?" And he goes, "It's my first day." Whee! Now, I want to remind you of his job description. And he saw that I looked concerned. And he goes, "Oh, don't worry. It's always my first day." I said, "What do you mean?" He goes, "Look, first day, you dress well, you show up early, you're good to your boss, you're nice to your coworkers, you stay late. You are never more committed to your job than you are on your first day of work. You are never more convinced it will be the greatest job you've ever had than you are on your first day of work. As soon as the second day comes, all of that starts to stop being so true." He says, 13 years ago, I started this job. I love it. And so I decide I will never have a second day of work. And you know what? It's been my first day for 13 years. And I was like, what a genius way of looking at the world. And then I got sad because that's how my brain worked. And I started to be like, how does this affect me? And I had just left my job because I felt like I'd been pushed out of it. And I started to think about all the things I wouldn't get to do and all the things that I had planned that I had to give up. And I started to think about the person I held responsible for. And I got angry. And I got quiet, which is unusual for me. And Mustafa thought that he'd hurt my feelings. And he said, "I'm sorry, Drew, did I say something wrong?" And I said, "No." And then I told this complete stranger, "This something's about to happen that's never happened on stage before." Okay, I didn't sneeze. I was like freaking out there. I'm like, I don't know how you're going to handle this. With aplomb, apparently. And where was I? Oh, and I said no. And I told this incredibly personal story to this stranger. And he got really quiet. And he says, "Drew, this person you talk about, they are so far away. They are so far away. It is night where they are, and it is day where you are. But you're letting them make it night where you are. You are letting them wreck Mustafa's grand adventure. And they're not even here. And what's worse, you're acting like it's their fault." And I was like, "It is their fault." And he goes, "No, it's your fault. Because you're letting her live rent-free in your head. Think about a landlord. They allow people to use their property. But they charge rent so they get something valuable in return. Your head and your heart are the most valuable pieces of property that you own. If you're going to let someone into your head or your heart, you had better get something valuable in return. This woman brings you bitterness, anger, and sadness. None of those things are valuable to you. But when you accept them for access to your head and your heart, you are basically letting someone throw a party in there rent-free." He said, "Drew, the landlord sets the rent. You're not allowed to be angry when all you get paid is what you asked for." And I thought, "Where did you go to school?" He goes, "Grade 5. He taught me more in one day for $350 of tour money than I did dropping $100,000 on education, which is sort of why you hear me rag on education a little bit, I suppose, but what can you do? That idea, though, that the true leaders I know, everything that we allow to live rent-free in our head, every person, every failure, every belief about ourselves that we allow to live rent-free in our head takes energy to carry them around. That is energy we cannot turn into value. You want to be an extraordinary leader? We've got to heal. A young woman came to me once and said, "Drew, I discovered in my life there is no universal measuring unit for pain. Hurt just hurts. But only hurt people hurt others. So if I want to be the type of person who doesn't hurt others, I've got to let go of the things that hurt me." And I think that is such a profoundly true thing. The problem is we carry conflict around with us. And you know why we do it? Because we want to win. Right? When somebody has hurt us, we don't want that conflict to be resolved until we know that somebody has acknowledged that we were right and that we won. Here's the thing. The most successful leaders I know, the truly happy people I know, they are not concerned about winning. What they're concerned about is succeeding. And sometimes that means letting go of the idea of winning. I'm 35 years old. I have buried 15 of my friends. I've been to 15 of my friends' funerals. I've been to 6 of their weddings. That is 3-to-1. That is a weird ratio. But what it means is that I've had to say goodbye to so many people in ways I cannot control, that any audience I speak to, when I can tell you, if you can save a relationship, friendship, romantic, family, whatever kind, if you can save a relationship by either saying I'm sorry or hearing I'm sorry, do it. Okay? Because there is almost everyone in this audience has someone that you wish was in your life, and they're not, and the only reason they're not is you haven't said I'm sorry or you haven't heard I'm sorry. Guess what? That is taking up energy in your mind that you could turn into value that is better for you and better for other people. Go fix it. All right? Everybody's got someone. All you have to do is say it or hear it. There is no weakness in forgiveness, and I think leadership begins where forgiveness begins. Coming up with these questions, coming up with these answers, identifying your values, what it allows you to do is add value every day that too often we're like, oh, it's a little thing. I only do these little things. I was hanging out with this brilliant person last night who kept telling me the same thing. Like, you know, oh, they're too small to really matter. Little steps can leave a huge footprints. I want to close today with a story of a guy. When I was lucky enough to tell that little story about the girl with the lollipop at an event called TEDx Toronto, and then it got picked up by TED.com, and a million people watched it, which kind of freaked me out. And they started to send me their lollipop moments, like these moments where people did these huge things that they didn't expect to happen. And they're all better than mine. So I'm going to close with somebody else's. And I'm going to tell it in his voice as if he's telling it. And he said, I grew up on a farm in a tiny little town. And I moved to Chicago after university for my first ever real job. And I'm driving to work on the first day in Chicago, and I see my first ever homeless person. And if anyone here isn't from a city, like, you might remember that moment in your life where you see a homeless person in person for the first time. And he goes, he was walking towards me with a coffee cup, and I freaked out because I had no money, and I thought, I don't know what to do when you have no money. And he goes, I started to tear through the car looking for like even any change. And I look up, and the homeless man is standing there smiling at me, looking amused. And he goes, hey, newbie, don't worry about it. If you don't have any money, just tell me, and I'll move on. But I'll tell you what, man, don't let this city get you down. It ain't beat me yet. It's not going to beat you. And I said, thank you, sir. And he went, okay. Show up the next day. I brought money because I was so embarrassed about the fact I hadn't had money before. And he sees me, and he goes, newbie, city beat you down yet? And I go, no, sir, you? And he goes, never. And I gave him a buck. And this went on for a year. And I found out his name was Larry, and this was the little thing that Larry did and I every day. Larry and I did every day. Hey, newbie, city beat you down yet? No, Larry, you? Never. So about a year in, I pull up, I got my dollar, and Larry comes up and goes, newbie. I was thinking, thousands of people drive by me every day, don't even look. You've given me money every day. You get to keep yours today. You've done your share. And I don't know why, but I reached in my wallet, I whipped out 60 bucks, and I held it out, and I said, well, then I guess maybe I should do their share then. And he goes, Larry looks at me, looks at the money, looks back at me, and he just takes it. He nods. He walks off. We keep doing this every day. And finally, about 2 years after that moment, I pull up to the intersection, but I'm not going to work, I'm on a date. I'm with this girl I'm crazy about, it's our third date. And Larry starts to come towards the car. And I'm like, I love Larry, but I have no idea how she's going to handle this. And Larry ignores me. He just looks back past me at the girl in the passenger seat and goes, hey, I'm Larry. This guy here, probably the only person in the world who knows that. Definitely the only person who cares. I want to tell you something. Since I first saw his scared ass here 3 years ago, he's given me $1,318.68. You're with a really, really special guy. Don't screw it up. And he walks off. And he goes, my wife told me on her first anniversary that was the moment she knew she was going to marry me. And I love that story because I think it gets right to the heart of what I think leadership is about. We put out this value into the world and we think it's nothing. We think it's insignificant. We think that we're doing it so that we can build to a moment where we actually can do something. That guy kept track. Larry kept track of every dollar that guy gave him, every cent that guy gave him. And that guy figured it was a buck and it wasn't important. The things that we sometimes throw away in our lives that we figure aren't important that we give to other people, we have absolutely no idea what impact it's having. I think that seeking out those moments is actually where leadership comes from. And everyone who didn't raise their hand, the fact of the matter is you're just not giving yourself enough credit for that's what you do. How many of you have what I would refer to as a lollipop moment? It is a moment where someone did something or said something to you unexpectedly that made you feel as if the world was fundamentally a better place, even for a moment. Raise your hand if you have a lollipop moment in your life. Okay? Wonderful. Of all the people who just raised their hands, how many of you have told the person who created that moment for you that they created that moment for you? Like less than half. I don't get that. All right, we live in a world where we celebrate birthdays, where all you have to do is not die for 365 days, and we will throw you a party. Seriously, don't get speed bumped by a bus. Here's a cake. But we let people who have fundamentally made our life better walk around and we don't tell them that. You know what leadership is? Tell the people who have made your life better that they made your life better. And every single one of you has been the catalyst for one of those lollipop moments. Every single one of you has said something or done something that changed somebody's life for just a moment for the better. Guess what? That sword has two edges. It can swing the other way just as easy. Every one of you is the catalyst for those regularly. The problem is, it is scary to think of ourselves as that powerful. It can be frightening to think that we could have that kind of impact when we're not paying attention. Because as long as we keep leadership something bigger than us, as long as we keep leadership something beyond us, as long as we keep leadership about changing the world, what we're doing is we're giving ourselves an excuse to not expect it from ourselves and from each other every day. Marianne Williamson wrote that extraordinary poem that says, "Our greatest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our greatest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It is our light and not our darkness that frightens us." I think if we're going to have more people raise their hands, if we're going to create true leadership for life, I think we've got to get over that fear so that we can move beyond it. And our little brothers and our little sisters and one day our kids can watch us value how much we can impact each other more than money and power and influence and prestige. I think it's time to redefine leadership. I want to redefine it as being about lollipop moments. How many of them we create, how many of them we say thank you for, and how many of them we pay forward. Because I think we made leadership about changing the world, and I argue that there is no world. There's just 7 billion understandings of it. And that means when you change one person's understanding of the world, one person's understanding of what they're capable of, one person's understanding of how many people care about them, one person's understanding of how powerful an agent for change they can be in this world and in their own life, I think every time you change one person's understanding of it, you've changed the whole world. It's not beneath any of us. It's not beyond any of us. It's the definition of leadership, and your ability to do it is one of the big reasons why you matter. I think if we can come to understand leadership like that, if we can define it like that, I think we can change everything. And I think we can do it with will and determination and grace too, okay? Guys, I think that's a simple idea, but that doesn't mean that it's a small one. All right, guys, thank you so much for letting me share with you today, and nothing fell on me in Montreal. Thank you, guys. Thank you. Very, very, very much. Thanks, guys. Whew. I'm still waiting for something to fall on me. Like, it's... I don't know what's next. I know you're all looking at me because... This is that awkward moment where I wait for someone to bail me out. Dear...
Your talk last time, when it was a frock,
I
was really
that,
good.
Yeah.
It was a really good talk.
Thank you.
I just wanted to come and tell you that.
Did, really?
Yeah.
You were...
Yeah, things worked out with that girl.
Were you...
You were still in love with.
No, they didn't, but thanks for bringing that up.
We like to remind you, I don't know.
Okay. Were you guys doing... Were you guys doing something else and had to get here in a hurry or something?
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay. Because I appreciate you coming and telling me that. I really do. It's just...
Yeah, well,
it looked like you were doing something else at the moment.
And
it's
really important to us.
Hey, Sarah.
Okay.
So, yeah. No, just, yeah.
Okay.
Great guy.
I appreciate. I'm gonna let you know. I'm probably not gonna forget this either.
I hope not.
Yeah, we worked really hard for this.
Yeah,
to look this good.
Yeah. I work out.
I worked very hard to not look like that because if I came in the same outfit, that's not a lollipop moment. Let's just put it that way. I take it you have something to like. You guys are. I'm so discombobulated right now, I have absolutely no idea what to do. Because you are a handsome dude, I want to be straight with that.
Is that who you're paying attention to right now, really?
Yeah.
I talk for a living and I have no idea what to say to that.
It's fine.
That's what we like to call a loaded question. And so, can somebody, there must be something where I'm supposed to, I gotta go. No, seriously,
okay,
thank you very, very much.
Thank
I
so
appreciate
much.
It. You guys are... Apparently, I missed a dress code thing. Montreal. This city. I swear to God, this city. Was that planned? Like, does anyone know what was going on there? Okay. So, it's not like just some big joke that you all planned beforehand, and I can't see anything. Somebody's got to be in charge right now. Are there any questions? Somebody ask a question, please. It can be a math question. I don't give a rat's ass. Do I just dismiss? Excellent. You should be... I'm so sorry. This is the weirdest thing. You should all get ready to move to your next workshop. Apparently you know where that is. I'll be working with some of you, but I'm going to need a moment.